Welcome to Division 3 of the Colorado Court of Appeals. We have two cases scheduled on our afternoon docket. Our counsel present and ready to proceed in Valley Grocery versus First National Bank?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. And how about in Day versus Johnson?
The appellee counsel's here. I don't see the counsel.
All right, that's fine. I assume that person will arrive soon. Have counsel received copies of our written instructions pertaining to oral argument?
Yes, Your Honor.
And?
Yes.
All right. And do you have any questions about those procedures?
No.
Okay. What I'd like you to do is to prepare and get set. When you're ready to go, you can proceed. But at this time, I'd like everyone in the courtroom to turn off all cell phones, pagers, and any other electronic device that makes noises, including BlackBerries, et cetera. And when you approach the podium, counsel, to begin your argument, please state your name and your registration number clearly. So, counsel, for the appellant, you may proceed when you're ready.
Ready to proceed, Your Honor.
Please go ahead.
Clinton B. Swift of Lynn Lawrence and Ottenhoff, registration 7127 for appellant First National Bank of the Rockies. At the core of this case is a debate that was the subject of a seven-day jury trial in Meeker in front of visiting Judge Buss regarding four loans that the bank made to Valley Grocery that the Steiners, the individual defendants, guaranteed by their commercial guarantees. The evidence at trial centered on the bank and Valley Grocery and the Steiners' breaches of their duties of good faith and fair dealing, as the court has set out in Wells Fargo versus Eoli case. Representatives of First National Bank of the Rockies and their expert witness testified at trial that the Steiners breached their promissory notes, their guarantees, the deeds of trust, and the security agreement and financing statement for the inventory loan. After the evidence established that Valley Grocery and the Steiners had defaulted on their loans by the closing of the second grocery store, the new grocery store in Rangeley, which created a default under the terms of the loan, then the Steiners proceeded by breaching their fiduciary, by breaching their duties of good faith and fair dealing. When they closed the Rangeley grocery store, they failed to take any actions that would protect either the property and or the inventory itself. They failed to attempt to market the property to reduce their debt or preserve the collateral or mitigate their damages, and resisted all attempts by the bank to assist them in finding another buyer for the bank, for the second grocery store. They closed the Rangeley store without preserving the assets. Ultimately, the bank was appointed receiver because there was a finding that, and an admission by the Steiners and Valley Grocery that they had abandoned the property without insurance in the middle of the wintertime, had failed to preserve the collateral or otherwise act in a manner that demonstrated good faith and fair dealing. They closed the Meeker grocery store after they lost their supplier. They operated it long enough to liquidate the inventory, which was pledged to the bank, the sale of the groceries, and contrary to their security agreement financing statement for the inventory loan, they transferred the proceeds from the sale of the groceries to another bank and paid junior creditors in derogation of the bank's senior interest in the collateral. After the bank arranged for new suppliers as part of the plan to liquidate, there was nothing more than a plan of liquidation. The plan of liquidation by the bank was presented on October 31st, 2003. It was rejected in writing by Valley Grocery and the Steiners on November 4th, 2003. The Steiners indicated that they would present their own plan of liquidation. They never presented a plan of liquidation. They proceeded to liquidate the collateral, transfer it, and pay other creditors and not the bank. Ultimately, the district court appointed a receiver to protect the assets against loss, to secure the premises for insurance, and to attempt to sell the collateral either by foreclosure or by approval by the court and by the Steiners and Valley Grocery. Several offers were made for the Meeker grocery store alone that were rejected by the Steiners, and ultimately the collateral had to be foreclosed upon. Once the collateral was foreclosed upon, the Valley Grocery immediately slapped a list pendants, even though there was a public trustee's deed to the bank on the property, further delaying any sale. And the evidence was clear at trial that the value of the collateral of closed grocery stores where there's little or no inventory continued to decline over a very rapid period of time. So the evidence was clear at trial that the Steiners and Valley Grocery, without reason or just cause, rejected the plan of liquidation, failed to provide their own, failed to mitigate their damages or preserve the collateral, abandoned the collateral, and in essence, you know, left it to the bank to salvage whatever it possibly could, while the Steiners did nothing to assist the bank and, in fact, impeded the bank's efforts at every turn.
Mr. Swift, may I suggest that in the 9 minutes you have remaining, you may want to begin to address the legal arguments that are raised in your
brief. Yes, Your Honor.
We're familiar with the facts.
The point is that there was sufficient evidence before the court, heard by the jury, of breaches by the Steiners of good faith and fair dealing, as well as there are allegations that were heard by the jury of breaches by the bank. The trial court, over the bank's repeated motions and objections, and contrary to the express provisions of the note, submitted the case for the jury rather than a bench trial in derogation of the express language of each of the four promissory notes.
But you got a jury verdict, didn't you, on that?
I'm sorry.
I said you got a jury verdict right against the Steiners on that, right?
Yes, we got a jury verdict, which was then set aside, but our objection was that the promissory notes themselves have a jury waiver in them, and the court, over our objection, submitted it to the jury. Then, not satisfied with the jury, both at the motion for JONOV of the Steiners, the court set aside the counterclaim verdicts. And
that's where I want you to sort of turn your attention for
and
the time
being.
What is the admissible evidence to support the jury verdicts against the Steiners?
As the court's aware, under Belfour, the damages are the exclusive provenance of the jury, should not be invaded by the court. The court, in this case, review of that invasion, if you will, is under Hall v. Frankel, is to determine whether the evidence is sufficient in the record, giving consideration and weight to the non-moving party, which is, in this case, the bank, every doubt and every inference in its favor.
So what is the sufficient evidence in this case? What is the sufficient evidence to support the jury verdict against the Steiners?
I believe, Your Honor, and that's why I focused on it to start with, that there was considerable evidence of the breaches of duty of good faith and fair dealing. There was expert and lay testimony, and under the Anderson versus Dutton case, that the jury verdicts and the counterclaim verdicts can be read consistently and consistent with the substantial evidence in the record of the breaches and the damages to the bank.
Well, assuming you established a liability, what are the damages? What is the sufficient evidence for the damages against this?
The damages are that flow naturally as a result of their failure to mitigate their damages or preserve the collateral. In essence, they wasted the bank's collateral because there was nothing in it for them, so they abandoned it, failed to preserve it, failed to mitigate, to do anything. And the bank suffered significant losses ultimately in trying to realize on its collateral. There's a debate in the record and a debate in the briefs as to Mr. Waller's testimony and the amount of the actual damages when they ultimately were able to sell the collateral. But the damages flowed throughout, and there was evidence of the amounts of the notes, the value of the collateral, the diminution in value of the collateral as the offers came in. They continued to be reduced over a period of time for the Meeker grocery store. It was originally, Meeker grocery store was projected to be worth $1 million to $1.5 million. Ultimately, the only buyer that was left after sitting closed for almost a year paid $800,000 for it. So there were considerable amounts of losses that the bank suffered because it was not paid all of its principal, interest, foreclosure, and all the rest of the cost, the collateral. We submit that the court improperly weighed the evidence itself, invaded the providence of the jury, disregarded evidence that clearly supported a verdict on the counterclaims, that this court, with a de novo review, should look at the facts to determine if they are sufficient and should attempt to read the jury verdicts consistent with one another and give every inference to the bank as opposed to the moving party for the judgment NOV. So we think that the argument, Your Honor, is in essence that the court should not have set aside the counterclaim verdicts. In the event that the court disagrees, then the issue should be submitting the case, remanding the case back for trial on all of the issues in front of the court and not in front of a jury.
Were all of the issues preserved up on appeal then?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe they have been. Unless there are other questions, that's...
Well, Mr. Swift, you did not appeal the jury verdict in favor that was entered in favor of the plaintiffs.
So that's correct, Your Honor.
So how do we have jurisdiction to order a new trial on those claims, which is one of the alternative things you're asking us to do?
Well, I believe it was improper for, and this court should look at the courts invading the jury's providence on the counterclaim verdicts, and that the verdict itself, you can't separate, as Mr. Coleman wants to do, the verdict from the counterclaim verdicts.
Well, I think we can. And if you did not appeal the jury verdict that was entered in favor of the plaintiffs, then how do we have jurisdiction to look at it?
Oh, I think you have jurisdiction to look at the issue of the counterclaim verdicts and whether they were proper or whether the court set them aside properly or not.
Not the counterclaim verdicts. How do we have jurisdiction to send it back to the trial court for a trial on both the counterclaim verdicts and the verdict that was entered in favor of the plaintiffs?
I think then the only real issue, and it's the issue we believe is proper for this court, is to sustain both the verdict and the counterclaim verdicts, that they shouldn't be read separate and apart. They are inextricably woven. So I'd like to reserve the rest if I can.
Thank you, counsel. You have a little more than 3 minutes remaining.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Joseph Coleman, registration number 6856. And I think I missed the colors on the wall that used to tell me my time, but I appreciate the new system. I want to start this by not going over the facts, but just very briefly putting them in the context. This is a situation where the plaintiffs, Valley and the Steiners, filed a lawsuit based on a number of torts, tortious interference, disclosure of confidential information, etc. These torts were not in any way based upon contracts. In response to that, there were counterclaims filed by the bank, and the bank did counterclaim based upon a promissory note and tortious interference. I mean, fraudulent conversion, excuse me. They also had a number of other counterclaims which they dismissed prior to the trial. At no time did they file any supplemental pleadings attempting to bring in issues such as list pendants or anything like that that occurred subsequent to the actual pleadings that form the issues. The trial court proceeded with a jury based upon the complaint, which asserted a variety of torts, all of which authorized a jury trial. The jury returned the verdicts, and the court is correct. They have not appealed not only the Steiner's affirmative recovery, but also Valley's affirmative recovery and the defense verdict for Valley. None of that was appealed. What we have is Valley winning on all issues, both a claim, not for much money, but did succeed, and on the defense against the note claim. The importance of that is that the obligor on the promissory note was Valley. Valley was found to owe zero on the promissory note. With the death of the promissory note through payment, the collateral documents also ceased to have any legal significance. Therefore, the fraudulent conversion claim disappears. You cannot have fraudulent conversion of an asset that the bank has no interest in. With the note paid, and with the jury determining that, and with the bank not appealing that, there's certain issues in this case that are straightforward. Others are confusing. I contend that these issues are the straightforward ones. Now we get to responding to the court's question. What evidence is in the record to support the, well, let me digress for one moment since we were talking about the jury. I think the court's questions also were perceptive in realizing that they are arguing to sustain a jury verdict. They spend, I think I calculated, approximately 50 pages of their briefs saying the jury verdict should be sustained. Then at the tail end, almost in a footnote type approach, they're saying, well, there shouldn't be a jury. I believe that this court is well aware that you cannot take the benefits of a judgment and at the same time try to challenge the judgment. So here they are arguing that the jury verdict should be reinstated, and then sort of tongue in cheek arguing that, well, we'd like to now raise again that there should be no jury. I believe that issue has been precluded by their own conduct. Now we get to the true substantive issue, which the court inquired about. What evidence is there to sustain a $633,000 counterclaim award to the bank? What the court heard is what they said in the briefs, a whole bunch of liability theories. Well, we could recover under liability theory A or liability theory B, and we'd like to amend to add liability theories, you know, C, D, E, and F, or however many more. They continually avoid answering the simple question. Forget theories of liability. You cannot recover unless you not only have a theory of liability that you prove, but also damages flowing from that. Damages. If after they filed an opening brief and a reply brief, they cannot cite evidence in the records to sustain anything close to $633,000. I'm not here saying that verdicts must be mathematically established, but when you cannot claim within hundreds of thousands of dollars what the jury did, the proper recourse is a judgment NOV.
Before the judgment NOV, there was actually a trial court offer of a remitter for $238,000, isn't that right?
That is correct.
What was that based on?
Based on two things. One, something that seems to be ingrained in the blood of judges, and that is, let's get cases settled. Let's throw some midpoint out and see if it sticks. That, I think, is the true basis for it, saying that, look, let's see if we can finally bring this to a close. Second, they argued that a promissory note was still outstanding, and even though they had not presented any calculations or any evidence in the trial, they started to say, well, maybe the jury added default interest. Maybe the jury did something else. Those issues are never argued to the jury, never presented to the jury. But by adding the highest possible claim, and they did claim $150,000, $158,000, I think, as unpaid on a promissory note. And the court even instructed, saying, in response to a question during the jury instructions, bank, what are you suing for? What are your damages? And they says, $158,000. So that's why there's a jury instruction that says the bank's claim is for the balance, if any, due on note 518. So what the trial court did was they took the $158,000, they heard Mr. Swift's arguments post-trial saying, well, maybe we get some default interest, maybe we get something else. And so the court said, what's the highest possible amount you could possibly be claiming? And Mr. Swift said, well, 238 or whatever the exact number the court just said. And so the court said, fine, bank, would you take a remitter down to the 238 if that's your highest possible claim? And the bank said no. So that was sort of the end of the discussion. So I get back to my point. I think it's a little bit of the judge trying to see if a compromise could be reached and giving the bank their wildest dream insofar as damages, just to see if they could come up with something short of having to set it aside. Because there's no question, the court properly said the jury wasn't prejudiced, and that's the reason why the rest of the jury verdict can stand. And the court was trying to move it along. But either way, even under the wishful thinking of theories that they thought of after trial, they could only come up to $238,000. And the trial court said, even if I accept that, that's not enough to support a $633,000 judgment. I've got to give a judgment NOV.
Now, their brief actually says that the bank president, Waller, had provided testimony for $617,000. Can you address that?
Yes. There's no doubt that the bank president, Mr. Waller, testified, and I think it was $690,000. As soon as the question was asked, and before it was even answered, I objected. I suspect the question was anticipating that, with luck, maybe opposing counsel wouldn't hear it, evidence would come in. But we did timely object before it came in, at which time we presented arguments to the court that you can't let in testimony of a bank president of conduct occurring after the foreclosure, after the deeds were issued, because what you're doing is you're impeaching the public trustee's bid amount. And all of the redemption rights, all of the public trustee procedures are based upon bank, bid what you want in the public trustee foreclosure. It's got to be in good faith, but they've got a lot of flexibility. But you're not forced to bid, any particular sum other than good faith. Once you bid that amount, Colorado law says that amount is reduced from the debt. Absolute. What the bank was trying to do is to come in and say, well, we want to bid, hypothetically, $1 million for this piece of property. Now, to redeem it, you're going to have to pay $1 million. But 2 days after we get the deed, we're going to say it's only worth $500,000, and we're going to sue you for the difference, as if it's a deficiency. Well, now they've defeated the redemption right, if you allowed that, because we'd have to redeem it a million, but they preserve a deficiency claim for $500,000. Trial court said, you can't do that. Court says, I'm not going to let it in. So they says, okay, we're not offering this evidence at all to prove the counterclaim. Not at all. That means not for liability, not for damages. Court said, fine, if it's not being offered to prove the counterclaim, we'll let it in. And he let it in because they were contending that we were suing for breach of duty of good faith. And he says, well, maybe it's relevant as a defense to show the bank's good faith. But he was clear. The record is clear. That's why I normally it's not quite black and white. I attach it to the brief where the court asked, is this for the counterclaim? Mr. Paul Swift stood there, eye to eye, looked the judge in the eye and says, it's not for the counterclaim. Now he's here in front of you arguing, let the Waller evidence in to prove the counterclaim. You can't do that. Obviously, it wasn't raised in the trial court. It was conflicted in the trial court. Shouldn't be raised here. Some of the collateral issues that come up in the reply brief, there's a reference to a case on the economic loss rule. All I'll say is that the economic loss rule is what precludes the bank from even having a fraudulent conversion claim, because they're resting on their security agreement, and their security agreement would require contract damages, not tort damages.
Mr. Coleman, I have a question about what happens at the end. You've indicated that we should just affirm the decision and not have a new trial. I don't understand that. The trial court ordered that there will be a new trial on the counterclaim damages. What's your theory that there will not be a new trial?
Okay, this is where I could find no authority to explain the difference between Rule 59, H and I. H says you can order a new trial. I says if there's a judgment NOV, you can take an immediate appeal. It's illogical to give someone an immediate appeal and they lose, and then you say, based on your loss, we're going to give you a new trial. I believe, looking at the historic way that that was resolved, is when a party decides to not take the new trial and rather takes their position in the Court of Appeals, they then are left with only two remedies. One, you tell the trial court, you made a mistake. Judgment NOV was wrong. They walk away with $633,000. That's what they want. They couldn't get that through a new trial because they have no evidence.
Right, but if you win and the JNOV is affirmed on appeal, there's no dollar damages.
That's right.
And it has to go to trial. So if we affirm the trial court's order, don't we also have to affirm the order ordering a new trial on damages?
Otherwise,
isn't that unfair?
It's no more unfair than what existed for however long the rule was written in its prior form, where someone was given a new trial, and they basically said, we will allow the recipient of the order for new trial to say, I stand on the record, I want to take the appeal right now. Right then and there, and we cited the cases, the consequences are, you may end up with nothing because the judgment NOV did take away their counterclaim recovery. So what I'm getting at is,
well, isn't that a Hobson's choice for them? Either they appeal the JNOV timely and bring it up to us before the trial court has an opportunity to hold the new trial, or they have to wait until the new trial goes forward and then they're late on their appeal of the JNOV. How can that be fair?
Okay, because under a motion for a new trial, you can always appeal the basis under which the new trial was granted, and going through the new trial does not waive it. So had they proceeded the logical way, if they wanted the new trial, they go through the new trial, then we'd be here one time, and they could be either arguing, we don't like the new trial at all, or we made a mistake in the new trial.
Well, let me ask about that. Is this really a final appealable order?
I believe that the Rule 59I made it appealable. Why it made it appealable, I hope you don't ask me, because I agree. The more I thought about this, I can't reconcile the subsections H and I. And the only thing I can say is I don't believe it was envisioned that when you gave a judgment NOV that you also add in the new trial. Because if you want to go with the new trial, they should have just said we grant a new trial and not treated it as judgment NOV. The trial court blurred those two subsections.
And in blurring it, could a court not, in its discretion, grant a new trial on the counterclaim issues because of JNOV-type reasons?
Oh, yes. I think that's what I'm getting at, is I think in this particular, in hindsight, the trial judge probably would have said, I'm going to give a new trial and not mentioned it under the judgment NOV. And as I said, by combining the two subsections, it became it basically became a headache, because every time I'd research it in one line, I'd get some conclusion. Research it in another line, you get a different conclusion. And all I'm stating is that what's unique here is he also entered some 54B on the parts that they didn't appeal.
Okay, excuse me just a moment, counsel, because your time has expired, but I want to make sure that Judge Daly is, if you have additional information you need, that
no,
you get it.
No additional information. My question is, without a 54B order, is a order granting a new trial a final appealable judgment?
I believe in this case, there is a final appealable judgment because the judgment NOV was entered, and 59I states anytime there's a judgment NOV, it can be appealed. It doesn't go further and say, what if you also add the language new trial?
Well, let me ask you this then.
And there was a 54B order also.
Is this really a judgment NOV? Because a judgment NOV, wouldn't it be not only it's against, you know, it's there's no evidence to support the jury's verdict, but there's no evidence to support any verdict for the bank. Wouldn't that be a judgment NOV? There's no evidence to support any verdict in favor of the bank. Isn't this really setting aside the jury's verdict because of insufficient evidence? Maybe I'd mix that up. So,
okay.
Go ahead, counsel.
Yeah, no, I think I just agreed with what you said. The judgment NOV was entered because the trial court could not find evidence to support the counterclaim. And the court also proceeded, if you look at an appendix that we put, or an appendix to their reply brief, they put in the 54B findings of final as to the other claims.
So, but he did not enter a judgment in favor of, in other words, total absolution of, in favor of Valley Grocery and the Steiners. He just simply said, gee, there may have been damages, but they weren't this high.
That is correct. And judgment NOV has always confused me insofar as when you set aside the jury verdict, you set aside it because it's twice what it's supposed to be, 10 times what it's supposed to be, or there's zero. And I agree. We do not have any evidence to sustain a particular number in between. And all I'm getting at is I believe the historic case law left the appellant in this situation at risk if they didn't take the new trial.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And Mr. Swift, we're going to add 2 minutes to your time.
Good point, Your Honor. First National of the Rockies did not stand on the record, did not elect its remedies. There was not a final order yet to appeal. The court's questions with respect of no evidence to support any verdict, it's clear from the record, clear from Mr. Coleman's answer brief, that he concedes there is evidence in the record that was argued at the hearing, but it was in the record, of a counterclaim verdict, even in the court's mind, with a remitter of $238,000. Now, Mr. Coleman quibbles in the answer brief and says, well, it could be $224,000, depending on how you credit inventory, or it could be $244,000. But Mr. Coleman doesn't quibble that there is evidence of a counterclaim verdict to be sustained.
Why is this a final judgment that you can appeal at this time? It's an order granting a new trial.
Well, because of the problems with the JNOV and whether that's a final judgment versus the order of a new trial. I mean, it is a Hobson's choice for the bank as to what it does, whether it goes through a trial, which may be meaningless given the verdicts.
Why couldn't you go through a trial and then appeal basically the earlier stance of the trial court requiring you to go through the new trial?
Because the order submitted by Mr. Coleman, adopted by the court with a zero verdict for Valley Grocery, makes the new trial meaningless, and it's the court's invading the providence of the jury, severing the JNOV from the counterclaim, that creates the problem in the first place. But when you look at the zero verdict for Valley Grocery, and then, as Mr. Coleman says, there are no longer any obligations of the guarantors, what the court has done is create a new trial on the counterclaim verdicts that, in essence, is meaningless. That's the problem with going through that trial and not taking an appeal at this point. We submit that there is evidence of damages, that Mr. Waller's testimony was not the subject of limiting instruction, such that what the court should do is reinstate the counterclaim verdicts. There are no limits in the jury instructions on breach of contract damages. There is no way that this court, any more than the district court, can determine what the jury did, how it made its determination of the JNOV, or the award for the Steiners and Valley Grocery, any more than it can determine the counterclaim verdicts, specifically because they're broad general verdicts. You can't identify the theory of an award to Valley Grocery versus the theory of an award, which claims the jury found in favor of which party. The court, over the bank's objection and the bank's instruction for a detailed verdict, gave the general verdict form. So we believe that the verdict and the counterclaim verdicts are so intertwined that you can't simply sustain the JNOV and sustain the denial of the counterclaim verdicts, that you have to affirm the jury's verdicts as a whole.
Thank you, counsel. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course. Are counsel present and ready to proceed in the case of Loretta Jean Day versus Bruce Johnson, M.D.?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Have counsel received copies of the written instructions for this court regarding appellate argument? Why don't you take a moment and receive those from the bailiff and review them, sir?
Yes, sir.